page 229, starting chapter 37, A Visit to England. In the spring, sad news came to me. Mrs. Bruce was dead. Never again in this world should I see her gentle face or hear her sympathizing voice. I had lost an excellent friend, and little Mary had lost a tender mother. Mr. Bruce wished the child to visit some of her mother's relatives in England, and he was desirous that I should take charge of her. The little motherless one was accustomed to me and attached to me, and I thought she would be happier in my care than in that of a stranger. I could also earn more in this way than I could by my needle. So I put Benny to a trade, and left Ellen to remain in the house with my friend and go to school. We sailed from New York and arrived in Liverpool after a pleasant voyage of 12 days. We proceeded directly to London and took lodgings at the Adelaide Hotel. The supper seemed to me less luxurious than those I had seen in American hotels, but my situation was indescribably more pleasant. For the first time in my life, I was in a place where I was treated according to my deportment, without reference to my complexion. I felt as if a great millstone had been lifted from my breast. Ensconced in a pleasant room, with my dear little charge, I laid my head on my pillow, for the first time, with a delightful consciousness of pure, unadulterated freedom. As I had constant care of the child, I had little opportunity to see the wonders of that great city, but I watched the tide of life that flowed through the streets and found it a strange contrast to the stagnation in our southern towns. Mr. Bruce took his little daughter to spend some days with friends in Oxford Crescent, and of course it was necessary for me to accompany her. Page 230. I had heard much of the systematic method of English education, and I was very desirous that my dear Mary should steer straight in the midst of so much propriety. I closely observed her little playmates and their nurses, being ready to take any lessons in the science of good management. The children were more rosy than American children, but I did not see that they differed materially in other respects. They were like all children, sometimes docile and sometimes wayward. We next went to Stevenson in Berkshire. It was a small town, said to be the poorest in the county. I saw men working in the fields for 6 shillings and 7 shillings a week, and women for 6 pence and 7 pence a day, out of which they boarded themselves. Of course they lived in the most primitive manner. It could not be otherwise, where a woman's wages for an entire day were not sufficient to buy a pound of meat. They paid very low rents, and their clothes were made of the cheapest fabrics, though much better than could have been procured in the United States for the same money. I had heard much about the oppression of the poor in Europe. The people I saw around me were, many of them, among the poorest poor, but when I visited them in their little thatched cottages, I felt that the condition of even the meanest and most ignorant among them was vastly superior to the condition of the most favored slaves in America. They labored hard, but they were not ordered out to toil while the stars were in the sky, and driven and slashed by an overseer through heat and cold till the stars shone out again. Their homes were very humble, but they were protected by law. No insolent patrols could come in the dead of the night and flog them at their pleasure. The father, when he closed his cottage door, felt safe with his family around him. No master or overseer could come and take from him his wife or his daughter. They must separate to earn their living, but the parents knew where their children were going and could communicate with them by letters. The relations of husband and wife, parent and child, were too sacred for the richest noble in the land to violate with impunity. Much was being done to enlighten these poor people. Schools were established among them, and benevolent societies were active in efforts to ameliorate their condition. page 231. There was no law forbidding them to learn to read and write. And if they helped each other in spelling out the Bible, they were in no danger of 39 lashes, as was the case with myself and poor, pious old Uncle Fred. I repeat that the most ignorant and the most destitute of these peasants was a thousandfold better off than the most pampered American slave. I do not deny that the poor are oppressed in Europe. I am not disposed to paint their condition so rose-colored as the Honorable Miss Murray paints the condition of the slaves in the United States. A small portion of my experience would enable her to read her own pages with anointed eyes. If she were to lay aside her title and, instead of visiting among the fashionable, become domesticated as a poor governess on some plantation in Louisiana or Alabama, she would see and hear things that would make her tell quite a different story. My visit to England is a memorable event in my life, from the fact of my having there received strong religious impressions. The contemptuous manner in which the communion had been administered to colored people in my native place, the church membership of Dr. Flint and others like him, and the buying and selling of slaves by professed ministers of the gospel, had given me a prejudice against the Episcopal Church. The whole service seemed to me a mockery and a sham. But my home in Stevenson was in the family of a clergyman who was a true disciple of Jesus. The beauty of his daily life inspired me with faith in the genuineness of Christian professions. Grace entered my heart, and I knelt at the communion table, I trust, in true humility of soul. I remained abroad 10 months, which was much longer than I had anticipated. During all that time, I never saw the slightest symptom of prejudice against color. Indeed, I entirely forgot it till the time came for us to return to America. Page 232 is blank. Page 233, starting chapter 38. Renewed invitations to go south. We had a tedious winter passage, and from the distance specters seemed to rise up on the shores of the United States. It is a sad feeling to be afraid of one's native country. We arrived in New York safely, and I hastened to Boston to look after my children. I found Ellen well and improving at her school, but Benny was not there to welcome me. He had been left at a good place to learn a trade, and for several months everything worked well. He was liked by the master and was a favorite with his fellow apprentices, but one day they accidentally discovered a fact they had never before suspected, that he was colored. This at once transformed him into a different being. Some of the apprentices were Americans, others American-born Irish, and it was offensive to their dignity to have a nigger among them, after they had been told that he was a nigger. They began by treating him with silent scorn, and finding that he returned the same, they resorted to insults and abuse. He was too spirited a boy to stand that, and he went off. Being desirous to do something to support himself, and having no one to advise him, he shipped for a whaling voyage. When I received these tidings, I shed many tears, and bitterly reproached myself for having left him so long. But I had done it for the best, and now all I could do was to pray to the Heavenly Father to guide and protect him. Not long after my return, I received the following letter from Miss Emily Flint, now Mrs. Dodge. Page 234. In this you will recognize the hand of your friend and mistress. Having heard that you had gone with the family to Europe, I have waited to hear of your return to write to you. I should have answered the letter you wrote to me long since, but as I could not then act independently of my father, I knew there could be nothing done satisfactory to you. There were persons here who were willing to buy you and run the risk of getting you. To this I would not consent. I have always been attached to you, and would not like to see you the slave of another, or have unkind treatment. I am married now and can protect you. My husband expects to move to Virginia this spring, where we think of settling. I am very anxious that you should come and live with me. If you are not willing to come, you may purchase yourself, but I should prefer having you live with me. If you come, you may, if you like, spend a month with your grandmother and friends, then come to me in Norfolk, Virginia. Think this over and write as soon as possible, and let me know the conclusion. Hoping that your children are well, I remain your friend and mistress. Of course, I did not write to return thanks for this cordial invitation. I felt insulted to be thought stupid enough to be caught by such professions. "Come up into my parlor," said the spider to the fly. "'Tis the prettiest little parlor that ever you did spy." It was plain that Dr. Flint's family was apprised of my movements, since they knew of my voyage to Europe. I expected to have further trouble from them, but having eluded them thus far, I hoped to be as successful in future. The money I had earned, I was desirous to devote to the education of my children, and to secure a home for them. It seemed not only hard, but unjust, to pay for myself. I could not possibly regard myself as a piece of property. Moreover, I had worked many years without wages, and during that time had been obliged to depend on my grandmother for many comforts in food and clothing. My children certainly belonged to me, but though Dr. Flint had incurred no expense for their support, he had received a large sum of money for them. Page 235. I knew the law would decide that I was his property, and would probably still give his daughter a claim to my children, but I regarded such laws as the regulations of robbers, who had no rights that I was bound to respect. The fugitive slave law had not then passed. The judges of Massachusetts had not then stooped under chains to enter her courts of justice, so-called. I knew my old master was rather skittish of Massachusetts. I relied on her love of freedom and felt safe on her soil. I am now aware that I honored the old commonwealth beyond her deserts. Page 236 is blank. Page 237, starting Chapter 39, The Confession. For 2 years my daughter and I supported ourselves comfortably in Boston. At the end of that time, my brother William offered to send Ellen to a boarding school. It required a great effort for me to consent to part with her, for I had few near ties, and it was her presence that made my two little rooms seem homelike. But my judgment prevailed over my selfish feelings. I made preparations for her departure. During the 2 years we had lived together, I had often resolved to tell her something about her father, but I had never been able to muster sufficient courage. I had a shrinking dread of diminishing my child's love. I knew she must have curiosity on the subject, but she had never asked a question. She was always very careful not to say anything to remind me of my troubles. Now that she was going from me, I thought if I should die before she returned, she might hear my story from someone who did not understand the palliating circumstances, and that if she were entirely ignorant on the subject, her sensitive nature might receive a rude shock. When we retired for the night, she said, "Mother, it is very hard to leave you alone. I am almost sorry I am going, though I do want to improve myself. But you will write to me often, won't you, Mother?" I did not throw my arms round her. I did not answer her. But in a calm, solemn way, for it cost me great effort, I said, "Listen to me, Ellen. I have something to tell you." I recounted my early sufferings in slavery, and told her how nearly they had crushed me. I began to tell her how they had driven me into a great sin. When she clasped me in her arms and exclaimed, "Oh, don't, Mother, please don't tell me any more." Page 238. I said, "But my child, I want you to know about your father." "I know all about it, Mother," she replied. "I am nothing to my father, and he is nothing to me. All my love is for you. I was with him 5 months in Washington, and he never cared for me. He never spoke to me as he did to his little Fanny. I knew all the time he was my father, for Fanny's nurse told me so, but she said I must never tell anybody, and I never did. I used to wish he would take me in his arms and kiss me, as he did Fanny, or that he would sometimes smile at me as he did at her. I thought if he was my own father, he ought to love me. I was a little girl then, and didn't know any better. But now I never think anything about my father. All my love is for you. She hugged me closer as she spoke, and I thank God that the knowledge I had so much dreaded to impart had not diminished the affection of my child. I had not the slightest idea she knew that portion of my history. If I had, I should have spoken to her long before, for my pent-up feelings had often longed to pour themselves out to someone I could trust.